really don't have any solutions, and I don't like movies that do. I want to create situations that give people something to think about. I hate a movie that will end by telling you that the first thing you should do is learn to love yourself. That is so insulting and condescending and so meaningless. My characters don't learn to love each other or themselves. End quote. Welcome to House of Words, a podcast about writers, screenwriters, and originality. I am your host, Jason Nemoor Hardin, inviting you to join me as we explore one of the most original minds to encounter the cinematic screen. This is an exploration into Charlie Kaufman and the screenplay that became his debut film, Being John Malkovich. He was born Charles Stuart Kaufman on November 19, 1958 in New York City. His father was the driving force behind the encouragement to teach Charlie and his older sister the value and joy in intelligent curiosity and the love of reading. Taught to read at a young age, he would soon find a fascination within the written word. This love of literature soon grew into an appetite for themes well beyond his years and led him to look for new adventures to explore on his parents' bookshelves. On those bookshelves, he found, among other books, Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451 and William Golding's Lord of the Flies, both of which expanded his mind and widened his horizon. From the fourth grade, he remembers writing his first story that blurred the lines between fiction and reality. During class, he and his schoolmates were instructed to pick out a famous explorer and write a piece about them. He saw this as a potential to do some exploration outside of the realm of the assignment and decided that his text would be one about fictionalized voyages with not one, but with various explorers. With illustrations to help the text, he told of these adventures, and even then, on some level, he understood the comedy which existed in the combination of fact and fiction. This urge to create would carry on, and during his early school years, he loved to read plays, being in them or imagine himself playing the characters he read about. There was a thrill in pretending that he was someone else and in a convincing manner, nonetheless. At the same time, he began writing comedic acts that were intended to be performed. Furthermore, along with his older sister, they would entertain their parents by staging plays in the living room, as well as shoot short movies on a Super 8 camera. So here you have the love of cinema growing alongside the love of literature, with the Marx Brothers and Woody Allen being favorites. What attracted him to the cinematic world in general and absurdist comedy in particular was how they would take you out of the reality of being alive, the convention of being a person, and of the things that are just accepted. He found that when comedy is good, it would do just that. It would question our very existence and our preconceived notions about the world, and well, he wanted to be a part of that exploration. Another comedian who would open Charlie's mind would be none other than the legendary stand-up comedian, Lenny Bruce. The controversial and often obscenity-filled acts would uncover many of the facts about human nature that were taboo. Bruce would push the envelope, but would do so by telling the truth, by exposing the truth, and by dissecting the truth, and he would do all of this while still being funny. At his high school graduation in 1976, he was one of three students out of 500 seniors in his class to be honored with the Diane T. Weldon Scholarship for Achievement Award, which was the school's drama award. With a love for writing and having made several Super 8 home movies by this time, he decided to pursue a career within acting and enrolled at Boston University. After a year, however, he became very embarrassed by the notion of studying acting and what that entailed. And perhaps because he secretly wanted to become a director, he felt a calling to go to film school in New York. In film school, he wrote a script which took place over one night about an insomniac trying to get some sleep. In hindsight, it wasn't too far removed from the style he would later perfect. In structural terms, it was fairly experimental, and as a result, his professor loved it. And the other student who was a favorite of his professor was a certain Chris Columbus. Though Chris Columbus and Charlie Kaufman were polar opposites writing-wise, the professor held up their two scripts as shining examples of what really good writing could be. Despite the fact that Columbus would find immediate success after school and it would take Kaufman an additional 11 years to achieve any kind of success within writing, his time in film school proved to be fruitful both on a personal and professional level. For starters, he would befriend Paul Pruck. Pruck would become Kaufman's writing partner, frequent collaborator, and the best man at his wedding. Unfortunately, Charlie would not be able to complete his senior film project in 1980 in time before school ended. The film, which was based on his insomniac script and which took place in the protagonist's head as he is trying to fall asleep, was an enormous endeavor, spanning 25 locations and 30 actors. So when the school year ended, he lost everyone that had worked on the project with him and was forced to finish it all by himself, which was quite the challenge, but one that he succeeded with, though not without some blood and tears. School days behind them, Kaufman and Pruck would write articles for the groundbreaking humor magazine, National Lampoon. They would submit letters and articles that ventured from the strange to the truly weird with stories like White Pig, Black Pig, about people migrating from body to body and into the bodies of famous people, including Lou Costello and Eddie Murphy. Now, the payment for the articles amounted to approximately 25 cents a word, which wasn't bad for two young writers, but what really mattered was getting their name in print. Nevertheless, when Kaufman received his first big check from the magazine, he was so elated that he Xeroxed it. During the 1980s, he found employment at the Art Institute in Minneapolis, where Pruck worked as a guard, and they continued to write together and send out unsolicited scripts. They wrote what is called spec scripts, which stands for speculative screenplays, which means non-commissioned and unsolicited screenplays for TV shows such as Married with Children and Newhart, but found no luck. For 4.5 years, he would mail scripts to prospective agents while working odd jobs in Minneapolis, Minnesota, which included a position as a clerk in the circulation department of the Star Tribune newspaper, answering phones for $6 an hour. He would wake up at 4 a.m. and catch a bus downtown, where he would then sit in a basement office to answer questions about missing or wet newspapers. It was far from what he imagined himself doing after graduating from film school, but gotta do what you gotta do, I guess. Then one day, 30 years old and living in Minnesota with his wife, he realized that his life wasn't going the way he wanted it to go. He soon came to the conclusion that he'd better figure out what he was going to do in the world of writing or give up the dream completely. Well, after taking a pause from writing scripts, he got back on the horse, intent on giving it his all and taking it seriously this time around. Now, a friend of his had an agent who said that he was willing to read one of his spec scripts. Charlie, excited, sent it to him, but the agent didn't get back to him. He, however, was not about to give up that easy, so he called the agent, nagging, begging, asking, pleading. He did this every week for a full year. Now, in the past, when people had rejected him, he had been ashamed of himself and had gone away. But now, with a newly found vigor and tenacity for his craft, and feeling more desperate than he ever had before, he persisted. After about 1.5 years, he was so fed up with waiting that he asked the agent's assistant if there was some other agent he could send his scripts to. In the end, It became a spec script for The Simpsons that impressed an agent enough to suggest that Charlie come out to Los Angeles to pitch his screenplays and hopefully get meetings with studios. So with absolute determination, he embraced the now or never attitude, borrowed $3,000 from his father-in-law, and drove his rusted out Volkswagen Jetta to Hollywood. No working air conditioner, mind you. Well, for 2 months, he tried his luck while his wife Denise waited back in Minnesota for good news from sunny LA. Unfortunately, he was striking out and unable to get as much as an interview. Then, just as he was ready to call it quits and head back to Minnesota for good, he received a call from the offices of the TV show, Get a Life. While getting that job was a game changer, it was also a nerve-wracking time for the timid soul he's known to be. For the first 6 weeks, he found himself unable to talk in the writing room, which makes it difficult to collaborate on a story with others. It wasn't as if he didn't want to talk, he simply was unable to. The stress and anxiety of the situation simply left him mute. He was sure he was going to get fired, and for reasons that he probably should have been, but luckily, he managed to overcome his mutism and wound up writing a few more scripts for the show. But something else was on the horizon, something much larger. Now, before we continue, I want to note that the following will be perhaps easier to appreciate if one has recently watched or rewatched Being John Malkovich. No promotion intended. Now, back to the story. Determined to grind away now that he had some success, he began writing the screenplay that would become Being John Malkovich while waiting for the next sitcom hiring season. His idea was to write the script and use it to get more sitcom work. The script would be a blend of two ideas that weren't going anywhere. Now, one story was about an individual who finds a portal into someone else's head. This individual would turn into none other than the actor, John Malkovich, whom Kaufman had actually never met in real life at that time. Now, the other story was simply one about someone having an affair with a coworker. On their own, the stories didn't amount to much. However, by combining them, he managed to create something that began getting positive feedback when he sent it around. People would read it and tell him how funny it was, and sometimes they would invite him in for a meeting about it. Unfortunately, all those meetings ended with him being told that though the screenplay was original and funny and really good, nobody would ever make it into a movie. It was simply too out there. So after more than a dozen meetings that went nowhere, he expected his script to go nowhere. But then enter Spike Jonze, who gave the script a read. Adam Spiegel, professionally known as Spike Jonze, was at the right time and the right place for Charlie Kaufman. Jonze, at the time, was an up-and-coming music video director and was antsy to make his first full feature. As chance would have it, he was dating a woman named Sophia at the time, who just so happened to be the daughter of legendary film director Francis Ford Coppola. The plot thickens. No, just kidding. Well, anyway, Jonze was given the task of reading the script Kaufman had sent to his future father-in-law. He was immediately taken by it. He felt it was unlike anything he'd ever read before and told Kaufman so. Kaufman then told him that praise for the script had always been followed by him being told that it was unmakeable. Fortunately, Jonze did not share this sentiment. After hearing the excitement in his future son-in-law, Francis Ford Coppola reached out to call the real John Malkovich to tell him about the project. Malkovich read the first 40 pages and then called his agent, asking him if he had read it as well. His agent told him that the screenplay was incredibly good, encouraging him to keep reading beyond the first 40 pages. Malkovich did just that, and his admiration grew even more. Accordingly, after reading the script for the first time, John Malkovich jokingly said, "Why does this guy hate me?" Now, here's an interesting side note for you. Before the call was made from Coppola to Malkovich, John Malkovich's business partner had perused the screenplay upon hearing about it and set up a meeting with Charlie Kaufman. The meeting was more of a security check to make sure that Kaufman wasn't some sort of stalker than it was one of genuine interest in the project. Well, the conversation did not go great. Get this. The business partner asked Kaufman what was his relationship to Malkovich. Kaufman felt it was worded in a way that made him feel slightly uneasy, so he tried to dance around it, explaining how he had always been a big fan of Malkovich and that he thought of him as a great actor. The business partner then asked him why the 7.5 floor was mentioned in the script. Kaufman had no idea what the man meant, so he very innocently said that he thought it would be funny and interesting visually to picture this half floor existing between two floors. The business partner then fired back, "Did you know that John's apartment number in New York is 7.5? Kaufman felt a chill run up his spine and couldn't understand how such a coincidence could have occurred. He knew that trying to explain to the man that it was but a coincidence, point blank, and that he was not a stalker would be difficult. However, there were little to no other alternatives. Fortunately, the conversation did not go much farther than that. Who knows where it could have gone? Back to Spike Jonze, who called Kaufman, obviously thrilled that someone wanted to make his film. Never mind the fact that he had no idea who Jonze was, he was just elated that someone, anyone, wanted to make his so-called unmakeable screenplay into a movie. While living in New York at the time, he immediately bought a ticket to fly out to Los Angeles to meet with Jonze at his earliest convenience. They agreed to meet at a restaurant. Kaufman arrived a bit early, as he is prone to do, and ordered a glass of soy milk. Well, suddenly, it was 12 minutes past their agreed meeting time, but he attributed this to Jonze perhaps just running late, which was reasonable as Jonze probably had a busy life. After 30 minutes, he was becoming annoyed. Why hadn't Jonze, at the very least, called the restaurant to let him know that he was running late? Maybe Jonze had called the restaurant, but no one had told him. He contemplated, looking over at the hostess area to see if there was a phone nearby. After 45 minutes, he was beginning to realize that this might never happen, that the movie just wasn't supposed to be. No, don't think that way. He tried to keep the positive thoughts flowing. Just the simple fact that Francis Ford Coppola and John Malkovich had read it was a reward in itself. It would certainly help him get more writing jobs. In fact, his agent had told him that work was already getting lined up. In the end, Spike Jonze never showed up, so he went back to his hotel room and packed to head back to New York. Jonze eventually called the hotel and apologized, telling how he was stuck in an editing room working on a commercial. You see, Jonze didn't have a cell phone. Unthinkable, right? It's easy to forget that there was a time before. Well, whatever the case, Jonze simply hadn't thought of the option to call the restaurant. With his tail between his legs now, Jonze then asked if they could meet the following weekend. It took a lot of thinking and pride swallowing, but they agreed to meet at Jonze's house, a place where Kaufman reasoned he would eventually have to show up. A week later, the pair dove into the script and worked on it for 4 intense days, going through it act by act and line by line. Jonze suggested that Kaufman rewrite the third act, as the original screenplay called for the main character and the devil to have a puppet duel to the bitter end, involving building-sized puppets, you know, Godzilla versus Mothra style. The devil's legion would then invade John Malkovich's body and finally rule the earth. Moving away from this ending, Jonze encouraged Kaufman to write a less chaotic and more emotionally resonant one, similar to the tone of longing and the frustration found in the first two acts. Following the suggestions, Kaufman subsequently spent months making revisions, thus the end was altered. Next came casting. Though Cameron Diaz wasn't initially high on the wanted list, she showed interest and was good friends with Catherine Keener, who was already cast in the film and whom wanted Diaz for the role. Diaz offered to read for the role, which was something someone in her position wouldn't have to do under normal circumstances, and which demonstrated how much she really wanted to play the role of Lottie. Well, she read for the role, and all doubt was vanquished. She nailed it. John Cusack had recently worked with John Malkovich in the movie Con Air, and after having read the script, was immediately taken by its originality. He grabbed the lead role of Craig soon thereafter. Everything was falling into place, save the casting of the main attraction, John Malkovich himself. That would take some more convincing. After speaking with Coppola about the script, John Malkovich offered to help produce the film. Though he liked the screenplay, he declined to star in it. Instead, he suggested William Hurt for the role. The producer soon asked Kaufman to change the name to another celebrity. That didn't sit right with them, though. Kaufman and Jones spent weeks flipping through names in order to draw up a list of potentials. For a moment, they considered Willem Dafoe, but thought the name John Malkovich was funnier when said repeatedly. The idea of being Christopher Walken was also mentioned, but Kaufman reasoned that Walken was too famous and that audiences had an already fixed idea of who he was. They were gridlocked. In the end, Kaufman and Jones made a pact to stand their ground and not deviate from the original title. One of the reasons that the writer in particular liked the title was because, although Malkovich was a well-known actor, he made great efforts to stay off the celebrity radar. In addition to the New York apartment with the half number, Malkovich had escaped Hollywood to live in Paris, where he would have greater privacy. This created an air of mystique around Malkovich, which lent itself to the story. Needless to say, for those in the know, the plan worked. John Malkovich agreed to take on the role of himself. From that point on, he encouraged Kaufman and Jones to go even further with making fun of his celebrity status. Malkovich basically told them to not be shy about making fun of him, which in turn helped create a satirized version of the real John Malkovich, which is what the film needed. In the end, Malkovich would look at the character as just that, a character, and not a representation of who he really was or is. Wow, what a sport. Way to go, John. Being John Malkovich hit selected cinemas on October 22, 1999, and would go on to be regarded as one of the best movies of its release year, and is to this day often included in best of all time movie lists. It would also be the start of Charlie Kaufman's impressive career, but that's for another episode. Concerning his writing process, Kaufman has once compared it to being lost in a park with a faulty map that doesn't lead him to his destination through the easiest available roads or paths. Instead, it throws him off the main road, forcing him to meet characters he wouldn't have met otherwise, some characters he maybe didn't want to meet, but needed to along the way to get where he needed to go. Sometimes the map guides him in circles, allowing him to see things more than once. This confusing and messy map thus gives him the opportunity to create paths for himself when it becomes clear that the ones aligned won't do. It naturally comes at a risk. He might just wind up somewhere he had no intention of winding up, some place he didn't want to be, some offshoot that will make him miss his deadline. But the reward, when it works, is being presented to unexplored territories and finding something new and original, something that works on a deeper level as well as on the superficial entertainment level. The process of being lost and of staying true to himself, even when it means getting in his own way along the process, is the key to how he is able to create the stories he creates. He is confident that if he would attempt to write like most other screenwriters seem to, he would not be able to bring forth the creations he does. Because of this, he is also careful about not following an outline, as it takes the excitement out of the spontaneity of the process. He has a story that he likes to tell that encompasses much of what he likes in a story. And I quote, "I'll tell you this little story. There's something inherently cinematic about it. I run in my neighborhood, and one day I ran past this guy running in the other direction, an older guy, a big hulky guy. He was struggling, huffing and puffing. I was going down a slight hill, and he was coming up. So he passes me, and he says, 'Well, sure, it's all downhill that way.' I loved that joke. We made a connection, so I had it in my head that this is a cool guy, and he's my friend now. A few weeks later, I'm passing him again, and I'm thinking, 'There's the guy. That's cool.' As we pass each other, he says, 'Well, sure, it's all downhill that way.' So I think, 'Oh, okay, he's got a repertoire. I'm not that special. He's probably said it to other people. Maybe he doesn't remember me, but okay.' I laughed, but this time my laugh was a little forced. Then I pass him another time, and he says it again, and this time he's going downhill, and I'm going uphill, so it doesn't even make sense. And I started to feel pain about this, because I'm embarrassed for him, and I think maybe there's something wrong with him. And then it just keeps happening. I probably heard it 7 or 8 more times. I started to avoid him." Now, Kaufman likes the idea that the story changes over time, though barely anything has really changed. What has changed is in his head and has to do with his reflection of the situation, his analysis of what is happening, and, just like with his movies, that makes all the difference. Whew, lots of twists and turns. Well, let's end this episode, like we are prone to do, with another quote from the original himself. "The only honest and generous thing for me to do is to give people myself. That's all I've got as an artist, so I want to do that in an unflinching way." End quote. Please forgive my voice for running dry, but the show must go on. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode and will spread the word about the podcast. Once again, I have been your host, Jason Lemoore Hardin. We here at House of Words ask that you please consider helping to make this show easier to produce and more frequent by contributing on our Patreon page at patreon.com/houseofwords or paypal.me/houseofwordspodcast. Alternatively, you can subscribe and encourage others to subscribe to our YouTube page, House of Words Podcast. Every little bit helps, more than you might think. Until next time, keep turning those pages. House of Words is written and produced by Christo M. Sanchez. Narrated and written by me, Jason Lemoore Hardin. And music by Creature 9 and Wood. All rights and ownership belong to Christo M. Sanchez and Jason Lemoore Hardin.